Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn are closed to the public as we do our part to stop the spread of coronavirus, Greenlight still strives for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators, speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Enjoy the conversation and visit greenlightbookstore.com for more.
Hi, folks. I'm Chelsea with Greenlight Bookstore. Good evening and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. We're excited to host tonight's event with Kathy Valentine, presenting her new book, All I Ever Wanted, a Rock and Roll Memoir, as part of our Brooklyn Voices series in partnership with St. Joseph's College. She'll be talking with Liz Winstead, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to everyone for making this happen, especially to our wonderful partners at St. Joseph's, whose beautiful venue we'd otherwise be having this at right now, and to all of you for showing up. Greenlight storefronts are currently closed and locked, but our community is still here. And finally, the reason we're all here, books. Bookstores are closed for shopping right now, but Kathy's book is available for delivery to your home. Our interviewer for this evening is Liz Winstead. As co-creator and former head writer of The Daily Show and co-founder of Air America Radio, she has helped change the very landscape of how people get their news. Liz continues doing stand-up, but spends most of her time at the helm of Abortion Access Front, formerly Lady Parts Justice League, an NYC-based reproductive rights organization that she founded in 2015. Known as one of the top political satirists in America, she has been recognized by all the major media outlets, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, Forbes, and as Entertainment Weekly's 100 Most Creative People. Her first book, Liz Free or Die, Essays, was released in 2012 to incredible reviews. She'll be speaking with our featured author, Kathy Valentine. She is a working musician and songwriter known for being part of the all-female band The Go-Go's. She wrote or co-wrote many of the band's most renowned songs, including Vacation and Head Over Heels. In 2017, she created She Factory, an event series to raise money for women-centered nonprofits. Her new book, All I Ever Wanted, is a roller coaster of sex, drugs, and of course, music. It's also a story of what it takes to find success and find yourself, even when it all comes crashing down. Kathy and Liz are going to start us off in conversation, and then they'll be talking with all of you. Kathy, Liz, please take it away.
Thank you. Kathy, first of all, I just want to say that I'm so excited to talk to you because we've been friends now since we met back in, I think, 2010, and I haven't seen you since quarantine. So for the audience, this might also be a crazy, just Kathy and Liz reconnecting and then talking about your book. And we met on Twitter, back when you could meet people on Twitter, and there was a group of us that started connecting, and it was Kathy and Nancy Franklin, who I see in the chat, who is the former TV writer and critic for the New Yorker, and just an incredible writer herself, Roseanne Cash, Sandra Bernhard, and Susan Orlean. And we would blab a lot on Twitter, and being women who were very close in age, had these kind of creative careers that were rooted in, I'm going to say, even though not everyone is punk rock, but rooted in a couple, I feel like hip hop, like punk rock is a way of life and a sort of thought process and in a way that you observe the world, and just sharing our stories. And I feel really lucky to be talking to you tonight.
Ditto. And those were some, I mean, that would be like my first getaways as a mom, and I would fly to New York just to have a fabulous lunch or dinner with these amazing women, and it was kind of, it marked the beginning of me and being a mom, you know, doing something like I used to do when I was single. So I have a lot of fondness for those get-togethers we used to do, and the friendships are enduring. And a lot of it's because, of course, like-minded in many ways. But I am so grateful to have you helping me amplify my book. And I knew you would get it. And I don't know, I'm really excited to be here talking with you, Liz.
Well, the book is so important for a lot of reasons, because for those of you who were looking for a juicy memoir about amazing rock stories, it is full of that. You are not going to be disappointed. It's incredible. For those of you looking for somebody who has shared experiences and is vulnerable and can talk to you about finding sense of self, feeling lost, trying to figure out what life is about, you are also there. And I love the fact that you don't hear rock stories, rarely you hear rock stories from the perspective of a woman who is in the business, right? It's always it's male centric, and so is comedy. You know, so much of me coming up as a stand up, so many of the parallels of what you write about in your book are so true. I want to start out with the fact that you raised yourself essentially. You had to find your way. You had incredibly horrible things happen to you. And you're the least bitter person that I've ever met. Honestly, you've been in situations where you have feared for your life, feared for your safety, feared for your future, and yet you were always positive. And I feel like, if you could speak a little bit when we kick it off, that I feel like in those situations, you never felt like you wanted to retaliate. You never felt bitter. You always felt like you just wanted answers. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you avoided being bitter?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because I never really thought of, I mean, it wasn't like I was trying to come across that way, and I certainly hope I didn't, because I feel like I've had this theme, and I saw it more clearly when I wrote it down and made order out of the chaos. And I felt like I just kept seeing this recurring kind of abandonment and betrayal. And my mom didn't leave me, but she certainly wasn't there to guide me in many ways. And I think that, but on the other hand, I looked to her as somebody, she seemed to me like a woman that didn't need a man, number one, that she seemed completely functional, and she seemed fearless. My mom seemed fearless to me. And I just feel like, I don't know. I was talking to my daughter about this. I don't know why it is that some one person will just kind of stay in something. For me, it's just kind of been a nature. It's not like I learned it. I think it's just a nature thing. It's just my nature to kind of look at the practical. I'm very, very practical. It's like, okay, what do I need to survive? What's going to be best for me? I got to look out for myself. And maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just a selfishness. Like, I got to look out for myself. And the best way to look out for myself is not to be mired in victimhood, not to be wallowing in self-pity, not to be sitting in the past, not to be blaming everybody around me or thinking about what I didn't get. None of that is good for me. So I think now that you ask the question and now that I talk about it, I would say my biggest reason for is just because I'm a survivor and I have to take care of myself. And that's the best way to take care of me, is to not be poisoned with bitterness and not be mired, you know. Moving forward is what's best for me. So I wish I could say it's because I'm some altruistic, you know, whatever, altruistic, wonderful, angelic person. But I think it's just me trying to get through life in the best possible way and do what's best for me and take care of myself.
But I would say, for those of you that don't know Kathy, she is all those things. You are a kind person. You are a generous person. You are always checking in on people. Like, you have found a way, I think, through your experiences of having to check in on yourself so much, I really feel like you are somebody who is an enormous giver, which I feel like the world is so much better with you in it. I loved reading your book for a lot of reasons in this time and place. One of the things, I want to just talk about your mom a little more, because I know how much your mom means to you, and I know that your mom was fierce and in the 70s. And in quarantine, I just started watching the show Mrs. America, which is about Phyllis Schlafly and how she destroyed the ERA and the coming of feminists. And I just want to read a quote that you wrote about your mom that was incredibly tied to me just watching this. You said, "Fueled by Virginia Slims and Lipton tea, she socialized in late night get-togethers with friends while I kept busy in my room." And I feel like that. I feel like Virginia Slims and Lipton tea were the fuel of all of the feminist movement.
It's so funny because my mom, there was never alcohol around the house. You know, my mom was never a drinker. There was people doing hallucinogens. I didn't know that, but some of my favorite friends of hers were UT academics that were into doing acid when I was a little girl. And they were my favorite friends because they'd like come in my room and, you know, pick up my stuffed snakes or whatever, my animals, and be like, bleh. So, but aside from that, and I didn't know what they were doing, she had an idealism and she was very swept up in a lot of the 60s kind of idealism. And it was a nice thing to be around. It was a nice thing as a kid to have that, you know, when you're a child, that's when you want idealism around you because you find out soon enough that it's probably not going anywhere.
Yeah. I do think that a lot of us who are in, I'm in my late 50s, you're just 60 or early, maybe you're going to be 61 this year, aren't you?
61, yeah.
Yeah. I had older siblings who were, I didn't know they were on acid either. I think we all experienced in our lives this sort of like, kind of, what is wrong with that person that they're just dancing for no reason in the kitchen with my dolls?
Yeah.
I think we experience a lot of that. For those of you who are curious about the book and haven't read the book yet, I'm going to make a suggestion because I did this and it was super fun. And it took me longer to read the book than I normally did. But every time you had mentioned some kind of music that was happening in a scene, I would go back and I would listen to that music, right? So when you talked about, you paint a really beautiful picture of going 4 hours to the beach and Steve Miller's Living in the USA is playing and you had passed out and you were on the beach. I went back, I found that song. And first of all, I thought they said Stand Back until I just played it now and it was Stand Back. I had no idea in that song. So twofer for me, I learned to not sing the wrong lyrics, but going back and playing the music when you set the scenes is a really fun way to experience this book. So readers, when you get it, go read the thing, go back and listen. Was that intentional? Because it was so visual.
Well, I got to say, if readers will do that, they're going to be doing what I was doing when I was writing. The very first thing I did, once I realized what my arc was going to be, and I knew when I set out to actually got down to the bare bones of writing, I knew that it was going to start in 1970. I knew it was going to end in 1990. I knew enough about writing to know that that was a good storytelling arc. I knew that me as the protagonist would go through a series of obstacles and come out a changed person. And that's what I wanted to do as a storyteller. But I thought, am I going to do it in a linear fashion? Yes, I am. Okay, so I'm going to start right here. So I just had this brilliant idea to go and make playlists of all the stuff I listened to. And there's so much at our disposal with the internet. So I'd start with 1970. I'm like, okay, I'm 11 years old. And what were the hits? What was on AM radio? What else would have filtered down to me? Oh, well, I would have seen, you know, these movie things. What was on the jukebox at the coffee shop? And I created for each year and I would listen to these playlists and it never failed to bring me back, because I didn't want to write unless I had feelings. I didn't want to just write about this happened and then that happened and then I did this and then I did that. I really wanted feelings. And until I could feel something and get connected to an experience, and the music helped bring me to the feeling. So if you do that, you'll be doing what I did as well to go back.
And it's so great to be in someone's process, because I wrote a book of essays back in which came out in 2012. And I sat down, I thought I was going to be writing a different book. And I'm from Minnesota and I went back to Minnesota so that I could connect with what I thought was important. And what I realized, part of your book is so much resonating with me, and I wanted to tell a story. We aren't visible. Women doing what we do and our process with which we came to do it, it's not very visible. And so to be able to bring what it meant to not be see yourself as a young girl trying to become a musician, trying to become a comedian, to be able to present a really visual work so that a young person reading it could see themselves, I thought was super important. And you have a great quote that I want to read and talk about when you said it. And it made me feel like so much. When you said, on being a girl, you said, I had no idea how jarring it was for men in the audience to see cute girls breaking out of the boxes those men had apportioned for us. A prototype experience that I would see replayed over and over in my career as a musician. I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about that statement.
Okay. I think I want to talk about visibility too, because mm-hmm. one of the things that kind of bothers me, and I think that the 60s and 70s were crucial times for people starting bands. A lot of those bands were, they're our cultural landmarks, you know, they're part of our lives. And, you know, there might have been more women in 1975 starting bands. There might have been more Kathy Valentines and Joan Jets and people if we had known how many women before us had done it. I had no idea. I had never heard of Fanny. I'd never heard of the women in the 60s that were watching the Beatles and going, I want to do that, and running home and starting bands. You know, there wasn't an internet. There wasn't YouTube. I couldn't look up female bands. And so they just didn't filter down to my world. And it's not like anybody was keeping them down. There weren't fanzines. It just wasn't something that filtered down. So I often wish and wonder if there had been more visibility for people, women that were doing that, if there might have been more and we'd have more women musicians and bands. So that's one thing about visibility. That word just kind of triggered me off into that thing. But more to address your question more, again, my mom, I have to give her credit. You know, she didn't fit into any box at all. She was absolutely beautiful. I write later in the book about her being just beautiful, or earlier, being beautiful and just gorgeous and smart, but she never tried. She wasn't trying to be attractive to people. She was just being herself. So she never fit in a box, even though she was gorgeous. And it's like, I just didn't think in terms of that. I didn't think in terms of, I never thought about getting married, or I never dreamed about my wedding. All I thought was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? How am I going to matter? How am I going to feel like I'm valuable and that I matter? That was my driving force and behind most of my ambition. How am I going to get really far away from this shit that feels really painful? I want to be very far from that. How am I going to do that? So it wasn't, and I think when I wrote that passage, it's like, I'm just starting my band, playing in that band. And it didn't even occur to me that the men in the audience had never seen that, and what it must feel like, never even entered my mind. And when I say it's a prototype experience, I still see it. I still see it. I still go with a kick-ass all-female rock and roll band.
The Blue Bonnets!
Yes, and we will pull into a place in 2020, and we will have the people, the men working in the venue, kind of like, you know, just a little kind of like, mm-hmm. You know, just like, you can feel the smirking. And I love it. I love it because I'm just like, you know, like kind of looking at my watch. Okay, 10, 9, 8. Because I know what's going to happen. What's going to happen is they're going to come over. They're going to be 360 degree shift. They're going to be nice. They're going to love the band. They're going to want to talk about guitars and gear. And it always happens. So it doesn't bother me. I just see it happen over and over. They think you're going to be lame. They think you're going to be probably, as in the comic world, they think you're not going to be funny.
Mm-hmm. You know? They think totally.
They think I'm not going to rock. They think I'm not going to, you know what I'm doing. They think I'm going to be shy, or I'm going to be girly. Or, you know, they're not expecting a lot of times to see. But on the plus side, it's always a very positive reaction. It's never like, you know, it's nice. I like the positive reaction.
Well, something that comes through in your book, and it's another reason why I'm so excited for folks to read it is your work as a musician isn't work. I believe that it's a vital organ for you. I believe that performing is a vital organ for you. And I feel like that comes through in your passion for it. It comes through in you'd perform no matter what, and you always have. The second you understood that feeling of what music and playing guitar or bass means, it's otherworldly. And is there, you put it into words throughout the whole book, you know, your relationship to your first band, to, you know, picking up a guitar for the first time, to, I love the story of you playing at the prison. That is one of my favorite anecdotes of celebrity anecdotes, because you were playing for the most vulnerable, and that experience must have been incredible of how it turned out.
I loved writing about that too. I loved remembering it. I had to call Carla, my bandmate, and just verify the things I remembered or fill in the blanks of what I didn't remember. I wasn't sure what song we played. So luckily I've maintained friendships with so many, everybody pretty much, that I could always kind of turn to people to fill in the blanks. But I wanted people to know what music was to me. That I, like you said, there have not been that many women that have written about what music is to us. And I kind of feel like it perpetuate the women who rock separation. And, you know, maybe it's a silly thing to care about, but I just feel like I'm kind of over the whole, I just keep seeing these women who rock, the women who rock of 19 of this year, the women who rock of 1990, the women who rock of 2003. And sometimes I just think, like, maybe if we were really integrated and talked about music and why we feel the same thing. I know women musicians, when, you know, like you ask a guy a lot of times, like, why'd you become a guitar player? And they'll go, to meet girls. That's an answer you hear. I know women that became guitar players so they could meet guys. You know, it's like, we're the same. We are the absolute same as the guys that start playing. And, you know, I'm fond of saying lately that everybody knows what Muddy Waters was to the Stones and what Buddy Holly was to the Stones and the Beatles, but you don't really know what made the women, like, who are our heroes? What was it about playing music? For me, it was not thinking. It was like turning off my brain. I think everybody knows what a pleasure that is. And whether you get it from meditating or praying or reading a book or watching a film or stuffing your face or whatever the fuck you do, you know, it's like turning off your brain is such a necessity and a luxury for a human being. And it did that for me.
To me, I grew up youngest of five kids, being on a stage, performing something I created, that I got to control the narrative around it. Let's be honest, I don't know if I can swear, but I'm gonna. No one's fucking going, hey, you know what we need? More women to weigh in. You know what? We just need to provide more stages where women can just get up there and just say some shit and bring their art and creativity, because we need to hear them, because we need to change patriarchy. Like, you know, if we don't do it, who will?
Yeah.
You know, your life is yours with which to take that and do it. It's interesting to think about too, just your evolution of music. You know, I think a lot of people, when they think of Austin and punk rock, they don't think of the Go-Go's, and I think, or they don't think of the Violators, you know, they think of other things, you know, and I love the fact too, that your experience in the Go-Go's and who the Go-Go's were and what y'all did and who you all were. Like, there's a great passage where you're like, they tried to make us sound like these girls next door. And if that means barfing in restaurants and fucking dudes in our hotel room and doing lewds and what does that even mean? Like, why must they? Is it so hard to look at women and femme presenting people and not understand that that's what they are? Must you put the word in front of them? Like, can't you just be incredible musicians?
Yeah, you know, and it's just, I think it's a lot better now. I think it is changing. I don't think women necessarily get smacked with, you know, the virgin, the whore, the girl next door, the butch. Or I don't think we get quite labeled as much. The bitch is always there, you know, if you complain too much or if the tone of your voice isn't right. You know, I see it, you see it in our poor politicians more maybe than in music. I see a lot a lot more variety and a lot more openness about what a woman can be. She can be large, she can be sexy, she can be Billie Eilish and dress, you know, you can do what you want pretty much as a woman now in music. But back then there were still those archetypes and stereotypes that were pretty firm. And once you had gotten to a point, once the Go-Go's had gotten to a point of success, it was kind of like, okay, what are we going to do with them now? You know, What is this? Okay. Well, they don't dress in garter belts and corsets, so they're not sexy. Let's see. They're not acting like men. They're not up there posturing and you know, so, okay. What is that? The girl next door, the sweethearts. You know, so it really felt like, okay, we didn't fit in some of the other ones, so that became ours. Well, but I love that passage too. And there's a great song I wrote for the soundtrack to the book called Bash and Crash, because that chapter says, you know, we came to bash and crash. And as soon as I wrote that chapter title, I'm like, that's a song. That is a song. And it's just, you know, we're not, you know, I'm not perky, I'm not cutesy, I'm not your sweetheart.
Well, and I think too, the thing I find just super interesting about being powerful and successful just for the sake of doing something that you love. It's kind of like, you know, we'll see a million stories about the woman who invented Spanx. She's a jillionaire. She invented Spanx. You know, it's like non-threatening to men. She has a big industry that she built that's not in the lane of a dude. But when if that woman wants to be the head of Goldman Sachs and all of a sudden the lane is there, then there's controversy, right? And the reason I bring that up is you talk a little bit about that in the book, where it's like, if they pigeonhole you as an all-girl group and this girl thing and give you lollipops and dress you in a certain way, then you can remain novelty. I believe that you said, I can't remember that you were it was perfect how you said it. But I can't remember. So forgive me.
Well, I think an analogy was like, I love this story. We got off the plane after a really long flight into Australia, and we got off the plane and the journalist took our picture, and we were a mess. We were dressed horrible. We'd had a 17-hour flight and, you know, puffy faced and just a mess. And then the next morning in the tabloid, it said, here's how the publicity machine of the Go-Go's would have you think they look. And they had our band photo from the, you know, our press kit, and here's how they really look. And you're just like, would they do that to Duran Duran? I don't think I've ever seen anyone do that to a male band. And
no.
Sadly, it still goes on. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time online looking at what people say about music. It doesn't interest me too much, but every now and then something will come to my attention and I'll go look at the dreaded comments, which nobody should ever look at any comments of anything ever, unless you want to lose all faith in humanity. But what it always comes down to is like, who's hot and who's not, you know, who's hotter of the Bangles or the Go-Go's, who's the hottest Go-Go, who's the hottest Bangle, who, I mean, it's just like, it makes me want to vomit. It just makes me want to gag. Okay. That's what people want to talk about. Okay.
So your book covers really touch tone moments that everybody would dream about, you know, opening for Bowie, the Stones. And is there somebody that is still on the wish list that you were like, oh, I'd really love to have played with? Fill in the blank. I was going to say X, but you know, I played with X. Fill in the blank.
I think Bowie and the Stones were it. I mean, there wasn't any Beatles, and you know, I don't have any wish list as far as that. They were both pretty mind blowing events and crucial things. You know, the Bowie thing came at a crucial time for the band when we'd really gone for our first really long stretch. And to anybody else, you know, things might have been coming across a part of the seams. But to me, anything that bolstered up my belief and my denial that this was going to last forever. You know, I was desperate for this to last forever. My entire basis of the band became not the dream of making it, but the dream of keeping it. It was how I could take care of myself. That's always been it. I got to take care of myself. That's been ingrained in me from childhood. How am I going to do it? This is how I'm going to do it. You don't take this away from me. So opening for Bowie after an 8-month really rocky stretch where Charlotte couldn't play guitar and whatnot, and to just go out there and kill it. And oh man, I just, my biggest triumph for me in writing this book was being able to say what it felt like in those times, you know. And I wanted the reader to know how excited I was and how much I loved it and how much I needed it. And so that they would also feel the despair and the loss when it was gone. I really, that was what I wanted to bring people with me. Cause I knew, you know, let's face it, I'm the bass player in the Go-Go's, you know, I'm not the most visible person. I'm not belittling myself. I'm a pragmatist. I'm not belittling myself, but I knew that if I couldn't make this a very human journey and bring people along with me on it, the book wasn't going to be the book I wanted it to be. So
Totally hit that, you know, and you hit, like, I was so excited for you. And when I was reading the Bowie chapter, I was like, I didn't go look to see, I didn't do any back research to be like, where are the pictures in that? I was wondering if something bad was going to happen. The buildup was so intense and there was just like Charlotte's hand and what's happening. And I was like, oh my God, please have this happen. Please have this happen for her. Please. You know, I was so invested in making sure that it happened for you and that I love that. But
I want to give a shout out also to the fans, because somehow I was able to find, I think it was just audio, it wasn't video, but I found audio of that concert because I had forgotten how we started that show. And we've never done the intro song like that. And I got to hear how it started, and hearing it put me, I was like, oh yes, that's right, we did that. And I felt the triumph of it again. So thank you, fans, for always kind of following and keeping the stuff coming.
That's always fun. I was desperately searching for the SNL when you were hammered, and I couldn't find it when you just, because you sounded, in as you described this SNL moment and being so excited to be on SNL and then being shit-faced, like, I really wanted to see what the manifestation of that was, but alas, I haven't found it. So if anybody has it,
it's out there, and it's not near as bad. It's not near
good.
As bad.
Good. One of the things I wanted to ask you, if you're willing to share, is you did a great job in the book talking about how you wanted to seize every moment and how you were, you know, you didn't like to be the person that had their own room. You really loved this like hyperized slumber party vibe and just being in it. And I wondered how much of that in hindsight was you not ready to sort of face your demons, or how you sat in silence. How do you sit in silence? How did you sit in silence back then, and what did it bring up for you?
I started when I was a child, I wrote about this a little bit. I was a big fantasizer, you know, I think I was a fantasy addict, and I think it's what probably started the neural pathways that make an addict an addict. I think that's your brain just starts, you know, reacting like an addict does. And from the time I was a child, I used to just stare. I mean, I could just sit there and stare. And sometimes in those early days in the band, that's what I would do. I would just find a place in the van or somewhere. And that was my silent time. I always was checked out. You know, I was either very involved. And when I say checked out, I don't mean I wasn't present. I was very present when it was fun and it was all happening and part, and then, you know, drinking and just keeping the feelings down was one very important, keeping the feelings down and also not being silent. I couldn't do it. You know, I wasn't capable. I was a very immature and undeveloped human being. And a lot of it was because of drinking. And a lot of it was because I was in a band. And you don't have to grow up in a band. You just don't have to. And no matter, even as you're getting older, you're still someone's, it's like, I have a chapter called Giant Babies. You know, it's like somebody, it's like, you have a babysitter. They're telling you what time to wake up. And if you don't wake up, they're going to come wake you up. And if you aren't packed, they're going to pack for you. And if you can't walk, they're going to carry you down to the bus. I mean, not that that happened, but that's just illustrating how everything is taken care of at that level. And so I didn't grow up for a long time. I didn't grow up till I got sober. And a lot of people have asked me, like, why did you write this book now? And it's taken me even a few months since it came out to real, not since, or since I, in the last few months, to realize that I wasn't able to be vulnerable enough to share what I shared until now, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that brings me to the last question that I'm going to talk to you about before we go to the Q&A. And that is, you share some very personal moments. You share basically sexual assault, and you also share about choosing to have an abortion in your book. And you and I met when I had really started deep diving into my activism around abortion, and you had started talking about it and shared your story. And I'm wondering how you feel about having that story out there in a time when I think abortion storytelling is super important. What made you feel like that was an important story to tell?
It was probably one of the hardest things I wrote about. And I'll say, I didn't write about one. I wrote about two, yep. Two abortions. Yep. And for the people that haven't read the book, the first time I got pregnant was really the first time I had sex. And I was 12 years old. And the next time I got pregnant, it wasn't from carelessness. It was because the diaphragm didn't cover the cervix or whatever it was supposed to do. And
diaphragms are a thing people used to use for birth control for the youngs.
Yes, exactly. And they had to be put in the exact right way. And so I felt it was the hardest thing to write about, number one, because I knew that there was a lot of very zealous anti-abortion people. And I knew that I was opening myself up to being judged pretty harshly. But I felt like, number one, it happened. Number two, I remembered it really well. And I think it's really important to tell these stories. And, you know, just the word itself is makes people just clam up. You know, they just shut down. You just say that word. I wanted to not even use the word. I wanted to say, oh, I got my pregnancy terminated. You know, I wanted to wrap it up. And I thought, no, you got to say the word. It's got to be, there has to be a humanity to these stories. And, you know, telling my daughter was really, really hard, you know? And I said to her, and I say to anybody, do you think a 12-year-old who is with somebody for the first time, a very lost, unparented 12-year-old who ends up having sex with a 16-year-old and gets pregnant, do you think she should have to go off and have that baby? I mean, really? Is that what she should do? Is that what a 12-year-old should do? No. Should a 22-year-old who has finally got a job and a career that's enabling and an entire group of people is dependent on her for her ability to show up day after day? Is she supposed to stop everything and walk away from her career and her dream of her lifetime and everyone that's counting on her to go be a drunken, immature, messed up mom? I mean, it's just like, and I finally thought it was worth being criticized and it was worth being judged to tell the story, because now more than ever, you know, God forbid if I hadn't had those choices. I mean, I wouldn't be alive.
Well, and I think it's true that, like, and also the same people that judge you would judge you for being a woman who decided to just buck any traditional roles. And let's be honest, if someone's not feeding you, fucking you, or paying you, let's not even value their opinion, because it should be way low on the totem pole. It doesn't matter. Like, I feel like you're doing great.
But
like, I feel like it should be on a shirt maybe. But yeah. So we have people who have questions, and I want to honor them because they're here.
Okay.
Zoom. And so let's talk. Oh, this is a good question. Kathy, the Go-Go's were my very first concert, 1983 at the Garden, and the most fun show at the beach at Mandalay Bay. What is your personal favorite or most memorable show that you've been part of?
The show that you were at, Ted, it was Madison Square Garden. I write about it in the book. Everybody knows what Madison Square Garden is. And I think for some of the girls, the Hollywood Bowl was a huge thing. But for me, that was amazing too. But Madison Square Garden, what happened was something that had never occurred before. And our lighting man brought up the house lights in the middle of the concert. That had never happened. And it was the first time that I saw, I think it holds 25,000 people all the way around, you know, and every single person was out of their seat and they were dancing to our music, five women, 23, 24 years old. And we're just playing our song and just kind of doing our thing. And tens of thousands of people are having a blast. And it was just like something about it just crystallized. And it's been my favorite moment in memory of the highlights of our career.
Can I ask you a logistical question about that? Can you hear yourselves? With that many people yelling, is it just reverberating in your body? Like, how do you hear each other?
Oh, well, on stage, it wasn't like the Beatles, you know, where that all you hear is the scream. I mean, there's huge sound systems, there's monitor systems, our amps are loud. Yeah, you hear the roar when you run out on stage, but people, they weren't like screaming the whole time we were playing. You know, they were dancing and there's, you know, roars of approval and applause, but they're not like, it wasn't like the Beatles in those early concerts where they're just like, it's all you hear is the hysterical screams. We didn't have that.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't know. I saw you open for the Police and people were as excited to see you in Minnesota on this freezing, freezing, freezing cold night. I'll never forget it. It was so exciting. And I never thought, it's so bizarre to think that you're my friend. And that you were somebody who was like inspiring me back in the day. It's so wild that we met through this other weird source and we're going through so many parallel things through our careers. I just, how fate happens is incredible to me.
Me too.
Somebody is asking about your dad. And I think this question is an interesting one. Did your dad know you were writing the memoir? And did you reveal to him about that you were going to be writing about that chapter where he said, I kept your record next to you?
It's a really good question, and I really didn't want to hurt anybody in my book. I don't want to hurt anyone. My mom is who I was most worried about, and I asked her every time. I said, I'm going to write about this. How do you feel about that? I would let her read it after I'd done it, and it really gave me a lens to see how supportive she'd always been. So while I was writing about the lack of parenting, I also got to see how supportive she had been as a mom. And it was more important to her that I write my story than have her look like a stellar, you know, pillar of parenting. My dad, different story. I took 8 months off of writing this book because my dad and I started having a relationship for the first time in my life. But sadly, that relationship was built on the last 8 months of his life. After he passed away, I felt like I could write the truth. I think if he had survived, I think I would have been a little gentler because I feel like it would have been hard for him to know how much it hurt me for him to have not been cared. And it wasn't that he didn't care. After he died, this is the thing that's crazy, you guys. After my dad died and I got all this stuff, I found a file. And I'm really emotional today, so I hope I don't start crying. I've almost started crying a few times. But this file had every single letter and card I'd ever written him.
Wow.
It had all my records, all my articles, everything. And it's like, after he died, I realized that I had mattered a lot to him. So, I don't know. It's weird. I had to write about what it felt like then. I wanted to write with reflecting now, but I also wanted to write about what it felt like then, you know?
And, yeah. I think sometimes when you are given the gift of hindsight, like those letters that you find, you can really find compassion. I'm not saying it makes the hurt go away, but you can find compassion in knowing how sometimes people are completely incapable.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know,
it's like in the book when I was talking to my mom, like, and I kept saying, like, "What were you thinking? What were you?" And I was like, and the book is funny like that because it is a memoir, but I'm also get to insert a little bit of me now, you know. So it's and that was part of the craftsmanship of writing the book, was like, when am I there? When am I now? How do I blend these things together? And I write about, like, what I wanted for my mom was to realize that she had been reckless and had hurt me really badly, and was okay, now's a good time to say you're sorry.
Yeah.
And it just didn't happen, you know, and I got to write, like, okay, I get it. You know, some people just do what they're capable of doing. So to go back to your question about my dad, which I can't remember what it was exactly, but
did he know you were writing the chapter about him coming to the...
I think he would have been really, I tried to be generous, but honest, you know, and I think him knowing, I think what would have hurt him was knowing that how sad it made me to hear that, because what I write in the book is like, I realized for the first time what I had missed out on, what I hadn't gotten. What I hadn't gotten was to be a little girl doing something and seeing her dad's eyes shining with pride. How many girls get to see that from their dad? I didn't get to see it. I got to see it that time, and I realized, okay, I have not ever had that, and now I know what I missed out. And even in my stunted emotional state, it pierced through everything. And for the first time I cried. So.
Yeah. Well, I hope you found freedom in that.
Yeah, a lot. And my 8 months with him were amazing, you know, before, and I stopped writing the book while I did that. And that'll be in the next book, writing about that.
I can't wait for the next book. Somebody asked this question, and it's one I wanted to ask too. It's from Ian. And Ian asks, what's your process of writing songs? How do you do it? Are you a notebook person? Are you a scrap of paper person? Has that evolved? Some people are like, I write in a notebook always, and then I'll enter it into my computer. What's your process?
Oh, wow. I don't have any one. I use the computer a lot more than I used to, because eventually it's going to be on a Word doc that I'm going to print out. And sometimes it starts looking more like a song. So I've used the computer a lot more, but I have boxes, banker boxes, filled with notebooks. I was just, the day before yesterday, I was just texting photographs to the Go-Go's of songs from our records. I was like, look, I've got the lyrics to this, and they're all scribbled out. I keep everything. So yeah, sometimes I think of it like antenna. I've always got my antenna out looking for inspiration. The inspiration might be a melody. It might be a phrase. It might be a line. It might be a topic or a concept. And I always notate it. And it's just kind of like this very vague, but accessible filing system in my brain. And if I start writing a song, like music, I'll think, oh, this could go with these words, or this could go with that idea. Or if I start, sometimes I start with the words, and I'll just start thinking, oh, that makes me want to do this. So I don't have a one method, and I love collaborating too, you know, so I just, and I'm also a big believer in incremental progress, because sometimes you just get stuck, and so okay, I'll move on to something else, and I'll write one line. Mm-hmm. Eventually it gets done.
So let me ask you this question. In the time of that we're living in the COVID time, and as we are fearing for so many things, and one of the things that we're fearing for is saving these really incredible cultural spaces that are small clubs. And our friend Maggie McPherson has a great question, and I want you to ask it with a couple of answers, not just one, and when it's not hard. But she asked, what was your very favorite small club coming up? And I think giving a shout out right now to some really great indie venues who are out there in the country that you want to say, let's make sure these places stay open. I'm going to say Cedar Cultural Center, First Avenue, the Bell House in New York. What are some of your places that you just desperately want to make sure that people are supporting?
Well, I'm going to stick with my home, my community, and say that Antone's Record Shop, Continental Club, Antone's The Bar, these are places that are so meaningful to me. Restaurants, you know, I sometimes I just think, oh, are these places going to be survive, you know? So I'll stick with my local businesses to answer who I hope are going to make it. Sea Boys, there's a honky tonk band that I go see a lot, and with my boyfriend, and I'm learning how to kind of dance to country music. And I would just really miss that. It's just been a really fun new thing in my life. But I loved our first tour because there was this, I called it the punk rock chitlin circuit, and there was these clubs across the country, and you would go in the dressing room, you know, you'd see like the graffiti from, you know, everyone that had gone before you, the Dead Boys and the Talking Heads and Blondie and the Ramones and, I mean, the Damned and all the bands that were to us, like, were way up there, you know, and we were following in the footsteps, and it was just really cool. But and some of them are still going. There's like Lugo's in New Hampshire, I think. And there was this amazing place in Charlotte called The Living Room. It was just like a little tiny place, and there was no stage. It's still there because I knew they were trying to save it. The Rat in Boston.
The Rat in Boston. The Rat is no longer there. It's condos, and that makes me feel really sad.
Yeah, the 930 Club. In Washington, D.C. Gosh.
And the Black Cat in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, but we didn't play there, so I don't know that one. I've got every single show. Like, I put together a really comprehensive list of every gig we did while I was in the band. And it was, there was a, what was the Agora in Cleveland. I mean, these were like, they had a lore around them, a mythology. Obviously, First Avenue, the Metro in Chicago. But I think that those were, like, by the time we got to some of those, we'd moved up a notch.
Right.
Because, you know, those weren't dumps. You know, there were dumpier clubs, but we had moved up to the nicer club by the time we got to Chicago and Minneapolis and stuff.
You know? Awesome. Is there anything that I didn't hit that you want to let people know? Like, I feel like there's so many takeaways from the book. I'm going to say fill in the blank for this question, okay? For Kathy's book, All I Ever Wanted, come for the blank, stay for the blank.
That, I'm supposed to answer that?
Yeah.
Okay, for my book, come for the dirt, stay for the, what's the other thing that's better than dirt? Come, stay for the magic. I don't know. That's pretty lame. Is there other questions that we should
ask? Yeah, there is some. Let's say...
One off, but I don't think I answered it very well, so we're moving on.
I think that you're doing great. So let's talk about learning bass. You were a guitar player, and you had to learn how to play the bass. How hard was that?
It was not hard at all. I thought I was a seasoned pro. You know, I'd been playing guitar for 5 years. The Go-Go's were my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th band. So as far as I was concerned, I was a pro. And even though I'd never been on tour and whatnot, but I just figured, you know, I could play it with a pick. It was less strings. They were easier to hit because they were bigger, and it wasn't a problem. And the one thing that's interesting is, like, my soundtrack that I did for this book, it's got some of my best bass playing and my best guitar playing. So it was cool because a lot of times I've always kind of said, I'm a really good player, bass player in the Go-Go's, but I'm not like the best bass player for other bands. But my bass playing abilities are perfect for that band because it's really about being able to groove and lock in with a great drummer and be melodic and come up with kind of melodic lines. But on my soundtrack, I was sometimes the bass stuff I put down, I'm like, oh my God, this is good. I had a blast doing that. And I really encourage you all to listen to the soundtrack. I'm really proud of it. And the audiobook comes, if you've already bought my book, and if you haven't, please buy it. This book tour was going to be sell lots and lots of books, and it's off the table. So I'm really counting on word of mouth, reviews, telling people, shouting it out. And if you've already got the book, check out the audiobook. It's super cool.
Did you do your own audiobook?
I did.
Amazing.
I did the reading, and they loved the music. Another thing I like to tell people, because I think it's always nice to hear this, is I was turned down by a couple of companies for my audiobook, and I was really sad about it. But then I ended up with an amazing audiobook company, and it made me, once again, you look back and go, thank God. It's like if somebody, like the person you really like, and they don't give you the time of day, and then you meet like the perfect person, and you're like, thank God I wasn't with that person. It's like sometimes the right thing comes along, and I have the best audiobook publisher, and they flipped out about the soundtrack, and they had me do music for underscoring the reading. So it's super cool and innovative. I might get a Grammy.
Well, I bet you will. We have to wrap it up. The book is all I ever wanted. Kathy Valentine. So thank you so, so much. And thank you for having me. I'm so honored to be in your life and to be part of this conversation.
Thank you so much, Liz. And thank you for everybody that listened. And I think I have several more of these coming up. So just find me on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, and everyone is going to be different. And thank you, Liz.
Thank you, honey.
Yeah, thank you so much, Liz and Kathy, for coming and talking to all of us tonight. And thank you to everyone who showed up. A reminder that you can buy All I Ever Wanted at greenlightbookstore.com to be shipped directly to you. Bye, everyone. Have a great
night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. There you can also find past episodes and links to purchase the books discussed. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.